Hello and welcome to Composers Roundtable, episode 12. My name is Sam. I'm here with Simin Amrugi, and also we are very honored and very excited to have the great composer John R. Graham. If you don't know about him, he has been involved with examples for Kingsglaive, Final Fantasy XV, Kirin ga Kuro, but also worked on projects like Avatar, Edge of Darkness, Night at the Museum 2, Benjamin Button, and The Mummy, just to mention a few. So we are very excited to have him here so we can talk lots about composition. So very much welcome, John. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Sam.
All right. So let's dig into a little bit more. Who are you? How? What can we tell our audience about you?
Well, I grew up in the woods in Virginia, and most of the music I heard growing up was just very small ensembles and bands. But when I was 14, we finally got a proper stereo, and someone gave us a copy of Beethoven's Third Symphony, the famous Eroica Symphony. And I played it, I don't know, 100 times, and I completely fell in love with music through Beethoven, as composers have been doing for 200 years. So I decided when I got out of university that I should go into the film business, because it's the only place that's really readily you can get your hands on a full orchestra these days. Mm. There's a concert thing, but you can probably count on one or two hands the number of composers who get really extensive performances in concert. Whereas with the movie business, you can get huge orchestras and choirs and the whole thing. And that has worked out really well. One of the avenues I pursued, you mentioned Avatar. I worked on a bunch of movie trailers, 100 movie trailers or so. And the great thing about movie trailers is that, I mean, Avatar is an exception because it was a very popular movie, but there are lots of movies that are not so popular. And once they spend $150 million on some movie that they know is, they are price insensitive about how much it costs to promote it. So they're willing to hire a full 80, 90 piece orchestra, a full 40, 50, 60 voice choir, and you get all the stuff. So movie trailers Wow. were a wonderful avenue for about 10 years. And that sort of bled off into some other things after that.
Hey, John, you mentioned university. So where did you initially start studying as far as being able to get in that environment?
Yeah, I went to Williams College, which is a very traditional liberal arts school. And I studied basically poetry and music. And I'd say one of the things, if there's something unusual about the way I think when I write, I spend as much time reading books and poetry as I do listening to music. So for me, the story and the emotions and the inspiration behind the story are really at least equally important, if not more so. And I went to graduate school at Stanford, and I studied at UCLA. And, you know, I did what a lot of people do when they get to LA, and I did 30 or 40 student movies, and wow. then finally got on my first feature film, which is called Full Contact.
I remember that one.
I was stunned by that movie.
Yeah.
Because I had never seen a kickboxing movie before. So they said, oh, it's a kickboxing movie. Like, everyone knows what that is. So I didn't know what that is. So I rented a few movies, and I didn't like the scores. And so I just wrote almost a full percussion score for that. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, if you're going to punch people in the head, that's percussion. So from but I just finished a Netflix movie called The Royal Treatment. Mm-hmm. That's a romantic comedy with the same director who directed that movie Full Contact many years ago. So, you know, sometimes you bump into people on low budget projects, and you end up later working with them on something that's, you know, a different genre and more fun.
It's very important to keep, you know, the contacts, the network. It really is. You never know what it leads. I guess Full Contact could be a romantic movie, in a way. the name at least.
Not the most romantic.
I forgot that it was so. I was quite young when I actually saw that. My friends were like, "Oh, you got to see this movie." But wasn't that a lot of synths in there? It's like 80s stuff, or am I forgetting wrong?
There was a fair amount of synths. I had a tiny little budget, and I hired some cellos and a saxophone and a guitar player and. A wind player as well. So I had some live instruments in it, but in those days, you kind of had to rely on sampled drums and synths for the sound. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's certainly no full orchestra. But, you know, cellos, they can play harmonics, so they can play really high.
Yeah.
And it adds a sort of flavor to the sound, even if you don't have a full orchestra chugging away. So it actually sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, I see a cello behind you. Do you play an instrument?
Yeah,
do you play the cello?
I do play a little bit. I took lessons for a long time, but I have to admit, when I want a solo cello in any score, I hire somebody to finish it off, even though if I might rough it out myself.
But it's always good to know an instrument. But can you see yourself a pianist, or is there a main instrument? Or
mostly a vocalist.
Oh, really?
So,
interesting.
Which I find very freeing. A lot of people are guitar players or piano players, and I play guitar and I play the piano, but I find the great thing about a voice is if you record yourself, you can record any kind of articulation. So
yes.
If you're playing guitar, it comes out as guitar music, but if you're singing, you can sing da-dee-dee, da-da-da-da-da, you know, you can add these colors and emotions that you can't really do on a wind instrument or piano or something like that.
I completely agree. That's so great to hear. I always said that the voice is fantastic to write with. You know, you can record yourself and you don't have to sound great, but you get the emotion, you get what you want to do, and then
sound great, but you don't have to.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I didn't mean that. I'm just saying that even if you're not a singer, you could use this, and it's so easy to keep the idea. You can even record it while you're walking, you know? I got this idea, and yeah, I totally agree. But, you know, I really was interested in that thing. You said you're a poet or have done poetry, and I didn't know this, and I thought it was really cool, and I just wanted to know, and the reason I'm asking is because I don't know. I've always gone for the music in my life. I've sort of ignored the lyrics, unfortunately, and it's not a good thing. It's just been my thing. I for example, we can just take somebody I really love, Joni Mitchell. I actually liked her music. I haven't always heard the lyrics. It was much later when I started to grow up a little bit and said, "Oh yeah, the lyrics are kind of cool too." But it was really the music I was going for, and I just want to reflect on that. How it is different to create music if you're also a poet, if you're thinking about the words and. So I don't know if you can tell us anything about that when you create music. Do you actually see words in your lines as well, or is it just music?
Well, I do sometimes. I mean, the reference to poetry for me is a little bit maybe more on the emotional side. That one of the things when I was just starting out, I had this idea, I'll write a bunch of kind of rubbish poppy sounding stuff that I can make money with. But the problem is, the problem with me at least was I was very condescending toward that format. And so the music I thought was quite mediocre and it's not going to get traction. I mean, the thing about people, the artists who are very successful in the pop realm is they're into what they're doing. They're not faking it.
Yeah.
So I really felt like that was a good exercise because now I'd never do that. Even if the movie is silly or the movie is overly dramatic or whatever it is, I try to find something about it that I personally find sincere and compelling about it. And I lean that way. So sometimes the music can be, I know because I've gotten this from producers and whatnot, a little surprising to them, but it's latched onto something about the scene or the movie or the story that to me is important and valid.
That's a great tip. I really like that. If you could say you steel man the project a little bit, you know, really try to see what is honest and true about this, no matter what you think.
No matter how weak it is, because some stuff is, you know, not that strong.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely know now when I started music, I was total snob, you know, only this music, everything else is shit, you know, but I kind of changed that way. You know, I really tried to see, you know, almost anything. What's if there's some value into it? And I think that helps.
That's very tolerant of you, Sam. But I have to say, I do think it's important to have strong opinions if you're going to be a creator. And so I don't fault you for that at all, actually. I think, you know, when I meet young composers and say, I hate so-and-so, some famous composer, I say, that's fine. Hate them all you want. What do you like and what are you into? And, you know, if you're into, you mentioned fusion before we came on, you're into that, then great. If you're into your kids, you know, there are a lot of movies with kids or with family moments. And I'm also a father and a husband, and that absolutely inspires me all the time, all the time.
So this is going to go in a really weird direction, but this is what I'm thinking of. So when you walk up to a strange dog and they're aggressive and because we've got a few next door, this is from personal experience. They know who you are, not because of what you're saying, or it's your body language. It's what you're projecting, and they sense that. So if I go over and approach them and I'm scared and that type of thing, they know it. And so they're going to get at me. So it's similar to what you're saying, John, that you have to have the confidence in who you are, and believe, you know, make the listener believe you. You know, there's some singers and that I hear, I don't believe you. It's not a matter of just reading off a lyric sheet and singing it. You have no emotional connection to it. I don't believe what you're singing. And so as soon as I get to the point where I'm confident, I can walk right up to that dog and say, you know what? I'm confident. I know that I know you probably are such and such, but you're not going to bite me today. And just today, I just walked over and just, you know, we're best buds now because they know who I am. They believe me now. They first saw this little, oh my gosh, here he comes, let's get him. And now they see someone who has a little authority. And I think that you have to, I think that's so important what you're saying, John, is that you have to really be secure in who you are, and you have to define who you are, because what you do is a result of that. And people are going to either believe you or not. They're going to listen to your music and go, it sounds good, but I don't believe that he's really believes what he's playing in that.
Well, yeah. So I think that's a really excellent point, Simeon, that you have to believe it. And I guess I would take it a little further, which is that if you don't adopt that posture, you're just defeating yourself. So if you're a young composer thinking, how do I be successful? The way you be successful is you do what you personally are into. You respond to the images or the scene the way you personally feel about it. If you think, well, I think we should have choir here, then put choir, no matter what they say.
Exactly.
I had a classic example of that, where I was asked to score a scene for a movie, and the composer, they'd already hired somebody, but I knew the music supervisor, and they were not happy with what they had. And they said, well, look, you know, the one thing we've tried everything, temp, everything, but the one thing we know we don't want for this scene is circus music. And I look at the scene and I think, that scene needs circus music. So I said, okay, I will write circus music, but then I wrote some circus music and they loved it. And that is just a classic example to me of, you know, the execution matters, but also you just have to do what you think is right, because the alternative is you do something that they tell you they want and you don't really want to do it. And it will always come out the way you said, Simeon, which is no one believes it. Mm-hmm. They don't buy it. I'm going to close my door. There's a little noise outside. One sec.
No worries. And while John is coming back, I just want to riff on that too. I really agree with what you guys have said. And the way I wanted to go back to what I said, that I was a snob, which is, you know, you can be one if you want to. But for me, it was actually liberating in the sense, like, before I had this like concept, I should only make this kind of music, jazz or whatever, or in this style. But now I'm more liberated to do whatever I want to, whatever comes to my mind. So it's more fun, actually. And I find that my music is more humorous sometimes, you know, if it works with it. Like you said, the circus music, perhaps. But it's just gives me more, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, I am more allowed to create whatever that comes to my mind. And usually, yeah, it's better music normally. And I'm having more fun.
It's freeing. It's a freedom. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as you were saying, Sam, a lot of people who want to be composers, you know, you don't suddenly decide when you're 25 you want to be a composer. I mean, I wanted to be a composer when I was 7. So I would hum things and sing songs to myself while I was mowing grass or doing some household chore. And then you go to university or you go wherever you go and you get lessons. and they say, oh, you know, good counterpoint looks like this, and good composing looks like that, and here's sonata rondo form, and whatever it is. And you realize, so then you get all these shoulds and oughts. You know, you should write music this way. You ought to write music this way. Music that's simple is for peasants. Music, you know, it needs to be complicated. It needs to be Richard Strauss. And I love Richard Strauss, but it doesn't all have to be Richard Strauss. Sometimes it can be Louis Louis. And Louis Louis has helped a lot of people fall in love and have a good time. So yeah. I think what you're saying, Sam, is really important for younger composers to just learn it. Don't ignore it, but then forget it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you need to use the tools as long as they're useful. And then when you don't need them, you get rid of them. Absolutely. I mean, there's so many forums like what plugins to use or what instruments to use and how you write all this stuff. And people are just attacking each other for doing the wrong thing. And I'm like, hey, who cares? You know, put in 68 violins if you want to. Who cares? Do a massive chord. If it sounds good, just enjoy it, you know. It's we don't need to go down with those rules so much, but it's great. It's important to study so you know the basics and then do whatever.
Right.
You
but
want.
Even Berlioz, as far I think,
yeah.
I don't remember when he wrote Symphonie Fantastique, but he wrote pieces for four orchestras. I mean, and then we're talking what almost 200 years ago, not quite, but pretty close to it. And so the idea of masses of resources, that's not so new. It sometimes seems a little new.
Well,
it's been around for a while.
Yeah, it's definitely fun to study music history. I know when I've done it, my students always hate music history, but I love it because you find out all these great things that people did. And have you seen that? Yeah, that was 150 years ago and you think it's new, you know? I just, I like that stuff. So listen, there's so many interesting questions, but I really was like latching on this. I see that on your website, it's a lot of Japanese. I think it is, right? So yeah. It's like, you speak Japanese.
I don't, tragically. No. I would love to learn Japanese, but one thing about when you're a child, you can get away with kind of a childish way of learning a foreign language. And so I learned French as a child, and I speak pretty good French for a child. But one thing about going to and trying to be a professional in a foreign language, that's a very risky thing to do. So fortunately, my wonderful agent, Koyo Sone, is originally from Japan. He lives in LA. He's an LA agent with an LA agency, but he's originally from southern Japan, and he is a brilliant, thoughtful, and contrary to popular belief, extremely honest person. And he translates everything and is just tireless about it. So,
wow.
But that show was a wonderful show because as we were talking about sincerity, that show was written by a guy, I don't know how old he is, but he's up there. And yet he gets the first billing in the show. The show is about a seminal part of Japanese history that resulted in the unification of Japan, which was by no means certain before that period. And so the show was written by the writer and the producers with utter devotion. And it was so satisfying for that reason. But one of the things they kind of liked is I write a minute of music, say 1 minute. I can write three pages or four pages of what I'm thinking of every little bar and what I'm trying to convey with this harmony, and the brass comes in and what's happening there. And so take one example, there's about a 17 minute piece in there, and I won't walk through 17 minutes, but you know, it's everything from, I'm thinking of Achilles in his tent, who won't fight at the beginning of the Iliad. I don't know if you guys have read the Iliad, because that's kind of part of what's going on in the story. And then he gets angrier and angrier and angrier, and he finally changes his mind and decides to fight. And that evolution is detailed out over many minutes. And so I wrote all this stuff down in English, sent it to my agent, and he translated it into Japanese because the show is very popular and a lot of people like to know what's going on with it.
Wow. So that sounds really amazing. So how did you get into, you talked a little bit about it, but how did you get into Japan of all places? It's quite a different culture from American, you know, or music-wise and story-wise and everything.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and there are so many examples of that. But I originally got introduced to video games in Japan with Square Enix. Square Enix is a major developer of video games, and one of their very popular video games that's been around for about 30 years is Final Fantasy. And so they decided to create a new version of Final Fantasy, episode 15. And they asked me to do the arranging for the trailer. Someone else, the original composer, had written the trailer, and she was writing for the game. And so I did all the orchestration, and I conducted and recorded here in L.A. Because they wanted a sort of a Hollywood sound. So that's what we gave them. And my agent said, you know, I think they're going to ask you to write for the movie. I said, well, there's a long way from arranging to writing for a movie. So they gave me a few little tests. They had me write a little bit of music for another game and a little bit of arranging for another game, just to make sure that it wasn't just a one-hit wonder. And then they hired me to do the movie. And I kept thinking, wow, they're going to fire me any day. And then,
as it turned out, they didn't. So. Yeah, it must be quite overwhelming. I don't know what you've done before that previously, but did you study the previous music, the games, or were they looking for a traditional score, something that was more Japanese, or did you have completely free hands? Or?
Well, that's a good question. They really did give me a totally free hand, except that the game composer wrote the main title. And she's a very, very popular and famous composer in Japan and a lovely, lovely person. And so her name is Yoko. So they said it was John and Yoko. So that was a little petty joke. But they did not want a traditional Japanese score.
Imagine that.
Because if they had, they would have hired a Japanese composer, because there are lots of great Japanese composers. And they wanted something more, I don't know, rock and roll or Hollywood. I don't know what you call it. But they wanted an enormous sound. So we hired that. We had a huge orchestra recorded in Nashville for about a week. Recorded in a little bit in Japan, a little bit in LA, and I guess that was it—just Nashville, LA. But we had a full resources for that. That was a fantastic project.
Exciting! Wow. So, did you go over there to Japan and
not that one, but I did go over for the TV show for Kieran. So, Kieran came about because NHK is the national broadcaster of Japan. It's like the BBC of Japan, and they have had this show on, it's called the Taiga Drama, since 1963. And it's a very interesting phenomenon, because I don't know of anything similar to it in any other country. I mean, there may be, but I never heard of it. What they do is each year they have a whole new team and in a completely different set of characters focusing on one person from Japanese history who's very seminal and important to Japanese history. And this time it was Mitsuhide, who is the villain of Japanese history. If you read any history of Japan, they will mention Mitsuhide's betrayal of Nobunaga, who was sort of in many people's minds in Japan, the George Washington of Japan. Now, like any kind of history, it's imperfect. It's in the 1500s. There's a lot of stories. No one knows if some of them are true. And so there's a lot of speculation. And as a composer, you have to take into account not just what you've read in history books, but what you know is in the popular imagination. Nobunaga, there are video games about Nobunaga. There's a whole bunch of them, actually. It's like a whole subgenre. So he's a popular, well-known character. So you have to take that in on board, too. But anyway, long story short, it was the same thing we talked about before, Sam and Simeon, both of you guys. You have to respond how you respond. So I had listened to all the themes they'd done for decades in the show, and they're fine, but I went a totally different direction. And then my agent, Koyo, he goes, he flies to Tokyo. He sends a limo around to the NHK people to get them out away from their phones and, you know, offices and everything to a recording studio. And he didn't even tell them he had a demo. But it's a cool place, has gigantic speakers, and he listened to them, and they told him what they wanted, and he said, well, actually, I have something here, and he played it for him, and I had written a letter about what I was thinking when I wrote it and why I wanted to work on the project, and it worked out. But, again, they were very careful. They flew six people over, I guess it was, to meet with me before I was really hired.
Yeah, okay.
Because, you know, a demo is great, but And they liked the demo became the main title, so they really liked the demo.
Really encouraging. I just want to say again, I mean, even we hammered on a little bit, that it's so great that, because it can be so frustrating if you're trying to sound like something else, you're going to hate the project because you're not satisfied, you're not doing what you want. And they hired you because they probably heard your music and like what you're doing. So you should continue to do what you do. So it's so nice to hear that you should go with your instincts and what you want, because that's probably what they hired you for. So it's really, really encouraging. I just want to say I have very little experience with the Asian market, which is huge. So I don't know much about it, but I'm sure it can be a sort of lot of lost in translation going on there. I was once hired by a company called Media Cube that in South Korea, it's quite big. They're creating music there. And they obviously wrote to me with Google Translate. That was so obvious. And their way of talking, it's like they really liked what I was doing, but I was like really scared because I didn't know. I couldn't tell if what they wanted. It was like one of the most frustrating thing I ever done. But I was really happy with the results and they were very nice. But I just wanted to say, I was like, wow, it's not just translation. It's like the whole different culture and how you behave. And I don't know if you have experienced anything like that from the Japanese guys.
There are different cultural things. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think there's a general idea, notion that Americans have this homogenous way of behaving, and there's a general notion that Japanese people have a homogenous way of behaving. But of course, that isn't really true either.
No.
I went to boarding school in England, and I grew up in Virginia, as I said, and people are very, very indirect in both places. Mm-hmm. So whether you're talking about England or Virginia, at least, not the rest of the U.S. necessarily, but a big disagreement where I grew up is to say, well, I don't know if I see it quite the same way. That is a throwdown. That's I flatly disagree with you. And of course, that's actually how a lot of people are in England. Not everybody. I mean, there are plenty of blunt people there too. But I think one of the common assumptions is that Americans are very blunt and direct and that Japanese people are very indirect. But I found I didn't find that to be the case at all. I felt that people were very direct with me. And fortunately, I had my agent to translate. So I didn't have Google Translate problem, Sam. But yeah, I think if you really listen to what people are saying, they're telling you what they want and what they don't like. Just because they're courteous about it doesn't mean they're not. Yeah. You know, and they like most of what I did. But of course, you know, there's some stuff they didn't like. So.
Yeah. So we're talking a little bit about new sample libraries that we're dealing with, perhaps more Asian Japanese music. So I wanted to give it over to Simin, perhaps, but asking a little bit what you were using and or how you got the sounds and all that, maybe.
Sure. Well, paradoxically, for both, at least the two projects we've been talking about, not so much the video game stuff, but because I have done some video game stuff that was traditional Japanese music. But for these shows, I hardly used any traditional Japanese instruments. There are some great sample libraries out there. Sonica Instruments is absolutely incredible. The only problem is you actually have to read the manual, but Sonica makes really good Japanese traditional instruments. But the other issue with any kind of traditional instruments is that they are always somewhat limited. They're limited in range and in volume and
harmony, I guess.
Yeah, really, in many ways. And say if you pick, you know, bluegrass music, or you pick traditional music of Germany or something, and yet there's some similarities. Like there are bagpipe type instruments in many cultures. There are double reeds. There are certainly wooden flutes absolutely everywhere. So I didn't avoid it. But since no one really knows what music sounded like anyway in the 1500s in Japan, I really went with the emotion first and used the resources that I thought would create that emotion, which often included a gigantic orchestral sound and a huge choir too, because it was momentous. These events absolutely created the Japan that we have today.
And I think it's a really interesting thing that because we come into things with our own biases and our own prejudices, and we look through the world with our own lens. And I think what's really cool is what we're saying is there's not necessarily a Japanese type of music or an American type of music or a German type of music. There is music, and the music interprets the emotions and the situations of that we all are experiencing life on this planet. And so music is a way to express the emotions. I keep hearing that word in our conversation, And that is the emotion. And that is something that everyone on this planet can relate to. Because listen, earlier this morning I was playing. I mean, there's nothing that can bring me into an ultimate puddle than some beautiful concertino strings. I mean, it's just like, oh my gosh, it's just like it just washes over you. And so, yeah, just like that, you know. And it's incredible. It's incredible how it's not necessarily the instruments, but it's the sounds that we're hearing. And it stirs something up inside of us. So this whole thing about, you know, there's this type of sound and that type of sound, and you've got to do this a certain way. Well, I think we're kind of just pretty much not completely throwing it out the window, but most of it, because it's about how does it make me feel? How does it suit the picture? How does it match what I'm seeing? Mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, Simeon. And I didn't avoid Japanese instruments, and there are some pieces. There's a seven, or I guess it's a six CD box set that Sony released at the end of the show. Mm. And there are a few pieces on there that really do sound much more flavored like traditional Japan. They relate more to the emperor. The emperor is a character in the show and has quite a number of very important scenes. And that music is utterly different from anything else that's in the score, as you can imagine. The emperor is supposed to have descended from the sun goddess. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about, like, so what's the sun? The sun glows, the sun burns, the sun is dangerous, but the sun is warming and comforting. The sun has all these attributes to it. Mm-hmm. And so I used a lot of symbols, you know, metal symbols, and I used a lot of brass and choir because I felt like brass and symbols, they can make it glow in a way that I associate with the sun. So you kind of make a few arbitrary decisions like that. But again, Simeon, it's back to your point that you have to say to yourself, how do I respond to this? How do I think about this? If I met the emperor, as you said, you know, whether you're Japanese or American or German, doesn't matter. If you met someone at that time, how would that feel? And that's what I want.
But I was wondering about this, but emotions, and obviously I'm talking mostly about my limited experience here, but I've worked with a few different companies in the world, and some on the Asian side and some of the European side. And I do find, even though these are generalizations, I do find that the Koreans, for example, South Koreans, they were very much into super emotive music. Just make it more emotive. They really wanted like to blood to come out of it, you know, and tears. While I presented some of those demo tracks for a French company, they were like, no, that is way too much. We don't like this stuff at all. And I just felt like, well, maybe there is some cliches here, but it does seem like certain cultures are more into that stuff, because I definitely felt like they wanted that. But I don't know. Is that your experience, that it's easier or no?
No, I do think that there are vogues and that those, you have to kind of pay a bit of attention to those vogues. Right now, it seems that, you know, you go to the movies and if it's a Los Angeles based production, there aren't too many melodies.
True.
I don't really quite know why what the result of that, unfortunately. I love cellular writing. There's a wonderful score James Newton Howard did for Signs. And whatever you think of the movie Signs, that score is amazing. It's like this three-note cell. Uses it all through the movie, turns it upside down, changes the meter, changes the register, changes the instrumentation, adds solo instruments on top. So you can be brilliant without writing a melody. Not that he can't write melodies, he writes beautiful melodies too. But I really have enjoyed working with East Asia. So I've done some projects with South Korea, for China, for quite a few now for Japan. And they... today, anyway, people seem to favor melody. And I, you know, who wouldn't like to write melodies?
Yeah, it's interesting. I definitely preferred myself. And this is just a personal preference. But I was just thinking for the latest Marvel movies that are being very big, very huge and all that. I personally have not been impressed at all by that music. It fits. It's well done. I mean, I'm you know, I will be happy to have done something like that. But I felt really the lack of themes. there is one, but there it's just in general, I feel like I'm not impressed. It's not going anywhere. It's just background music to me. And I was wondering, maybe if I'm correct in this analogous, maybe it is they don't want it to interfere too much. They just want the action to be on visually, and the music is just enforcing that. And if it comes in too much, I don't know. What do you guys think? Am I off there?
Well, I mean, I think it also depends a bit on the audience and what the audience's tolerance is for breathers. So one of the things that I would say is common in action movies produced in America is they are absolutely nonstop packed. There is not a 2 second breather anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's always trying to be at 11, turning it to 11 all the time. By contrast, in this show I worked on, there is one example I'm thinking of right at the moment where a character is trying to make a decision. This woman who loves him asks him a question. There is a 30 second, it is not shorter than 30 seconds, pause while he thinks. There's no music. There's background sound, they're outside, but it's 30 seconds. You wouldn't find a 30-second gap in a Marvel movie to save your life. And I think that it's just a totally different mindset, those movies. Those movies are roller coaster rides. It's like, come on, everybody, let's have a 12 French horn section. Let's have 8 trombones. Let's let it blare the whole time. And that's kind of the experience I guess that the audience is looking for those movies. Yeah.
So, well, in that example that you mentioned, how powerful was that 30 seconds? I mean, I could just imagine it. Just you're gripping and you're just like, okay, come on, answer them. Because you're the theater. I think the thing, one of the cool things is the things that you don't hear and you don't see, the theater of your mind, it starts to fill those things in. And I think that, and because when you're going da 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 da, you know, ah, boom boom, you know, you just like you don't have a breather, and it's so frenetic, and then you don't know what the story was about. What did I just see? But it's just like that 30 seconds of silence. It seems like it just kind of sucks you in. It pulls you right into the mind of those characters. I couldn't imagine. Because I'm thinking, when I'm watching a movie, I'm always thinking about, okay, what's happened? What's going to happen next? Or what is this person feeling in this moment? So the roller coaster ride is real. But I think we need those breathers to establish context. And I think that's what music helps to do so much. It helps to anchor the context sometimes.
Could it be that dynamics is really like, you know, it's been this, what do you call it, forgot the word because my brain, you know, the music has been pushed all the time until it was said in Europe at least, like no more, you know, cannot maximize the music beyond a certain level. Everybody's just pushing the music, the popular music at least, to the limit. So there's no dynamic whatsoever. Is it sort of the same thing in the movies, perhaps, at least the action movies? Because I also find that music with dynamics is way more refreshing and interesting. The Ghibli Studios, if you're familiar, you know, with the Japanese, I love them because they have that dynamic. I mean, there are many more studios and movies from Japan, right, but obviously. But in general, they have the pauses, they have the dynamics. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good example, Ghibli Studios, and I think those movies are beloved all over the world. Mm. But as we're sort of all agreeing, I think that's a completely different mentality and intention than Marvel Comics or a roller coaster ride, which I put more in the same context. I mean, those movies are enormously popular, and so I really don't fault them for what they are. And I'm sure it's incredibly gratifying to write that kind of music that with those sorts of resources. But nevertheless, I love to be able to think a little bit about what I'm working on. And one of the things I enjoy about video game music is that the pace is so much slower than, say, TV is, or even a movie, that you can really think. And the people you're working with are not so... Honestly, they're just not so afraid, because when you're working on a movie, often the director's been working on it for 5 or 8 or more years.
Mm. Wow.
And if it bombs, man, that's a lot of time down the drain. But with a video game company, you have many people working on it. And honestly, if one video game is not as successful as you'd hoped, you still got a job. So
that's actually a really good point.
Plus, if they don't like something, they say, well, we don't really like that. We like this part of it, but can you do more with that? Or can you make it more exciting or more emotional or whatever it might be?
It's a really good point. I haven't thought about that because I actually haven't worked too much with video music, video game music. I would love to, if anyone's out there. No, anyway. But that you have the time because, the game is longer. It's play. There's more moments. It seems like you're more free, right? You can play more with dynamics and you have all these different moments, right?
Free. And also, I just don't get as many directions from video game people. I mean, they have some temp ideas, but they're not necessarily as married to them as sometimes can be the case with a movie.
I just feel like sometimes there are these massive, I don't know if you play games, I love to, I don't have time, but there are these massive role-playing games that, you take 200 hours to complete. And I imagine the people creating music for that, I don't know why I'm throwing that out, but it seems like a lot of work to fill all that content. I don't know.
Well, it is a ton of work to fill all that content, but I guess... the other thing about video games is video games are being rolled out in various ways now. It used to be that you did the whole game, you put it on a Blu-ray or whatever you put it on, whatever format, and you shipped them out. But now, of course, most things are not done that way. And you see video games being rolled out in segments. So you'll get the first, 5 segments, and then they add another one a few months later and another. So there's the production process has changed a bit as well. And that's really fun. It means you can change directions a little bit. You can have a section of the game that sounds a little different. I think video games are very promising for young composers. I would absolutely go that way because and plus they want to differentiate themselves. They are willing to hire a big orchestra. They are willing to take chances. I forget, there's a video game that's been very popular that my son loves, which I kind of enjoy too, and there are no strings. I think there's one solo violin, that's it. So you can do some unusual stuff, even though it's orchestral sounding. It's not a synth sound.
Do you find that it's okay today to not... I mean, obviously, we all want real orchestras, but the samples are pretty good. Do you find that it's okay to use only sample contact nowadays?
Well... I think you have to do what you have to do, but I don't really like that.
Okay.
So no matter how small the budget is, if you can just get one live player or one singer, one cellist, one clarinet, anything, something living, breathing that connects the notes and sells what you're trying to do, I think as a young composer, a lot of people don't do that. I think it's a huge blunder. For a lot of reasons. First of all, you need to learn how to do it, and your music will sound so much better 3 years from now than it does today. So if you did something in 1998 and it was all samples, you can really hear that. But if you did something in 1998 that had some singers or it had even a string quintet covering the sound, it sounds okay still. So I really am a huge believer in selling the emotion and sincerity with real players, even if you can only afford a handful. And if you have 100, even that's even better.
That's a great tip, really, and it's also more fun to work with other people, because I know for myself I'm guilty of doing all myself, sitting here in my studio, and it gets a little lonely. So at least to have other people to actually hire a cellist or a singer or whatever, it's it can be more fun, more inspiring. You get more ideas.
It's so much more fun. It's a lot more work.
Well, there's a synergy that happens. There's something about working with other musicians, and the two become greater than the sum of their parts, and the synergy that happens. When you're hearing a live player, and then when that live player is overlaid on maybe a synth part, it brings such it breathes life into the Tin Man. It puts a heart into that into that inanimate, pretty much what's going on. It breathes that life into that. So it's just an incredible thing. And then as you know, and then anytime that you can be around real musicians, I'm always a proponent of, if you can go see a live orchestra, go see it. If you can go hear a live, even if it's something that you're not necessarily a big fan of, go see it. Expose yourself to as many real experiences as you can, because that deposits something in you that will come out. At some point, it's gonna come out. You know, yeah, I totally agree. You know, it's John, you just having that live element is incredible.
It is. I mean, I sing in a choir. I've got actually some Handel right here. I sing in a choir every week, and it's kind of a relief to sing someone else's music from time to time so that you don't have to think about, well, but should I change that? You know, because you're not going to change Handel. So, or Buxtehude or whoever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I love that. just experiencing from the inside someone else's compositions every week, it's just a wonderful. Even if you're in an amateur group and you're not even that good, it doesn't have to be that great. Mm. I think one of the problems with modern culture is that people feel they have to have a lot of equipment or training or a coach or something to do the simplest things, riding a bike. You see people, at least in LA, with what looks like $10,000 worth of stuff, you know, these really expensive bikes and all these clips, and I don't even know what. But, you know, you go to Amsterdam, you just see little old ladies riding around on a bike.
Yeah, you know, and that's actually one of my problems. I'm well aware of it, but it still happens. And I'm kind of, in a way, lucky that I'm not super rich, because I think I would buy too many things, too much gear. And that would actually be what would hold me back, because I would then, you know, figure all this stuff and buy more things. And it's great to have things, you know, but it probably would stop me from writing more music in my case.
It reminds me of a classic Dick Van Dyke episode where he's trying to write his novel, and he goes to the cabin up in the mountains, and he's got to have the right kind of pencils, the right kind of paper, and so he's just, you know, it's all about the tools and the, you know, and he winds up not writing anything except for the dedication. So I think that's the trap we all fall into. Man, man, this new library just came out. I know if I got that, I'm gonna be able to write better music with that. No, it's just another pencil. If you don't know how to write to begin with, it doesn't matter what kind of pencil you have. You can pull one out of the drawer and write something just as beautiful as you can with a Mont Blanc that costs $2,000. It's all in the, I don't know, it's not necessarily about the tools, it's how you use those tools. You know, the great sculptors can pick up the same chisel and hammer as I do, but I'm sure not going to make a beautiful statue. I'm going to make a mess. So it's like, it goes back to our very beginning of our conversation about just learning and just learning the basics and then just going from there. It's incredible.
I agree with that. And I guess one of the delightful things that you can get now is some actual real Hollywood scores. In fact, some of the very best scores, I think, written in recent years. There's Omni Publishing produces any number of scores, but one of them is How to Train Your Dragon. Mm-hmm. If you're a young composer and you want to learn how to orchestrate for picture, you buy that score and you're finished. And the other thing is, you don't have to study every bar of it or write it all out. I mean, I heard that Wagner wrote out by hand with a quill, of course, all of Beethoven's symphonies. I don't know if that's
true or
not.
Yeah, I heard that too.
but that, whether that's true or not, it really helps to get under your fingertips at least a few bars here and there, even if it's just four bars or eight bars. See how they do what they do. How do they voice the chords? What are the trumpets and the trombones doing? What are the French horns doing that's different from them? And how does the guy think about it, or the orchestrator? So there's so much emphasis, I find, on chat boards about composing on the libraries. And I don't think that's totally misplaced at all. I have at least 10 string libraries, and I use all 10 of them for different things. And I don't know how many choir libraries, same thing, because they all sound a little different, even the shorts. You know, so if you have an orchestra, you say, dig in a little bit more violas. Mm. But you can't do that with a sample. You can talk to samples all day. They don't respond.
Mm. So
you have to, you have to have that other library that where they do dig in more and substitute it. So, but that said, I agree with what you guys are saying, that it's really important to at least know how the other guys who do know what they're doing, how they do it.
Mm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. A while ago, I thought about we should ask you if you have any good tips for beginning composers. But I feel like that's what we had been talking about, you know, the last 15 minutes. But anyway, do you have any more good tips on perhaps how to start or perhaps if you want to get into game composing or movie composing, anything that anyone who wants to try
I do have one thing. And this is a huge mistake I think I made for 10 years. Okay. Maybe two things. One thing is be yourself. Mm. Write what you think is cool. If you think it's cool, even if 9 people out of 10 don't think it's cool, there's going to be somebody who says, hey, I hear what you're doing there. That is a little bit unusual, and that's a little different. So I made the mistake, and I think a lot of people make this mistake. I loved the scores I heard. I loved Jerry Goldsmith and John Williams and Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard, absolute musical genius. But if you ape those guys, first of all, they're pretty good. It's not very easy to do that, to imitate them in a way that's successful. It usually just sounds like a pale imitation.
Yes.
So don't do that. Do something wacky or weird or just what you're into. If you like Elgar and that's the kind of music you want to write, then write your brains out and keep working on it. If you want to write avant-garde stuff where you're tapping on your desk and that's what you're sampling, do that. But be yourself. So that's one piece of advice. The other piece of advice, if there is one, is don't bother chasing after agents, because agents are fantastic when you're negotiating or you're having a hard time getting paid by some company. Mm-hmm. They get you paid. They can maybe get you a better deal. They can make sure that you don't enter into something that's mistaken. But trying to get an agent in order to get your first gig, waste of time. Just get your first gig. Then call the agents.
Yeah, that's
or wait
good
for
advice.
Them to
actually,
call you even better.
Mm, nice. Yeah. Excellent. That's really, 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 really helpful here. I was thinking, what is your future thing? What are you working on next? What's happening for you?
Well, I have one thing I'm excited about, which is another video game in Japan project that I'm pitching for, and I've been working on a video game for a Chinese company, and I don't really know how public it is, but Xi Jinping, the head of the Communist Party in Japan, has recently, as our audience might know, come out with a wanting to limit the amount of time Chinese people play video games.
I've heard that, yeah.
So that project, I've been working on it all year. It's actually on a little bit of a hiatus now where they wait for the dust to settle and see what happens with that. So, but I've got basically two video game projects, and I had a really good time working on this Netflix show with my old buddy, Rick Jacobson. So we'll see what he's doing next too. We've worked together a lot over the years.
All right. Yeah, something
that's
to look
so
forward then.
Yeah.
So I will link everything in the video here, but I just wanted to hear, where can we find out about you if you want to know more about you or where you have your music or what projects you're in?
Sure. Well, it's all on Spotify and Amazon Music and iTunes, and it's John R. Graham. And so you can find it that way. You've got my website up there on the cast, and that there's quite a bit of information there in English and Japanese. And But it's I just love the orchestra. And so I'm not really much of a songwriter. I've written a few songs, but mostly it's orchestral based stuff. And I just love it. I've kind of gravitated a little away from the hybrid sound lately. I feel like that. And maybe
been done to pieces.
Well, maybe it's been done to pieces. And also one score I've really enjoyed of Hans Zimmer's recently is the Dunkirk score, which really isn't a hybrid score so much. It's really a synth score to my ears. I mean, I'm sure, and I always got real instruments too, but I love that audacity to take a subject that could not be more of a mythologized subject, the retreat from Dunkirk, of the English. I mean, every English or UK citizen knows about that episode in history in World War II. And instead of using traditional brass and choral instruments, which is what you kind of expect, no, he goes a completely different direction. And I thought that was really wonderfully provocative and audacious and refreshing.
But do you think that you kind of need that license? I was thinking also as, for example, Johnny Depp, the actor. I know that when he did Pirates of the Caribbean, he just did what he wanted. And I know that the film crew weren't really like so happy with that choice because they had their sort of style, what a pirate should be. But he was Johnny Depp and he did what he wanted. And he ended up working great. But if you're not that big, if you're not Zimmer, you know, Hans Zimmer, I mean, can you still... Yeah, I mean, we've said all the episode that, yes, do that anyway. But what do you think? Is it more difficult?
I think you have to do that. If you don't do that, honestly, you're writing yourself into a corner where you're just going to get mediocre derivative movies and stuff that sounds like, sort of looks like some other movie that the director had in mind. I mean, if you want to work with people who are doing something audacious, another example of something really out there is There Will Be Blood.
I haven't seen that.
Absolutely nuts movie just to start with, but it's also got a very, very unusual avant-garde string-based score. And I don't know how you could have the movie without the score. And that's the kind of marriage that I think all of us should strive for. So you're right. You might get fired.
But yeah.
So what?
Yep.
Life lasts a long time.
I'm thinking about Danny Elfman too. I mean, just another example of somebody that comes totally out of left field, out of another dimension, but has made such a huge impact because he wasn't afraid to be himself. Many years ago, it was like just going through that imposter syndrome type of thing. Where you find yourself playing what you've heard and whatever, and you're trying to emulate others. And it's just like, I make a terrible somebody else. And it's just like being comfortable with that and walk into those sessions like you have the collateral or the gravitas of a Hans Zimmer. You have to walk up to those angry dogs like you're Hans Zimmer, and they're going to say, "Oh, it's Hans." And so, you know, you project, you know, people are going to feel what you project. If you are projecting cowardice or you're not sure of yourself, man, they're going to know that. I think this has been such a great, great session today because it's just helping us to understand it's okay to like yourself. It's okay to like your likes, like what you're doing, like the music that you like, because we are all totally different. The world would be such a boring place if everybody was doing John Williams music, but like John, what you're talking about is like, if you're doing what you love to do, then that's going to stand out because everybody else is doing this, but you were faithful to your convictions and whatnot. And so that hand is going to be seen. The director is going to say, "Oh, look at that. I see you. I see you there. I hear you." So, this has been wonderful. I've enjoyed it.
They might not like it, but at least they know there's a person behind it instead of just a generic 10-note chord.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's also, it sounds a little bit different, but it's also something I teach composition at a school here in Sweden, and we talk a little bit about, you know, how do you approach people and stuff like that. And I even think Alex, another YouTuber here, is quite big, who does trailer music, talks about this, that a mistake we often do is that we try to be the jack of all trades a little bit. Oh, I can do everything. I can do reggae and banjo, whatever. But it's kind of the same line. Show what, like one specific thing. Hey, I'm really good at circus music, you know, or just as an example or whatever, and pitch that if you love that, if that's what you want to do, if that's what you're interested in, and you don't have to show everything to everybody because you shall sell yourself short.
Well, but that's very true. And one of the dumbest things you can do, I think anybody can do, myself included, is branch out into genres that you really don't know what you're doing with, whether it's the number of painful comedy cues on people's websites, just if it isn't really funny, just don't put it up there. Yeah. You know, and also, just as you're saying, Sam, you can't do necessarily reggae and Strauss and cartoons. It just isn't like that. No one wants to hire you to do all those things. They want to hire you to do a thing. So put up your very best, most personal, most differentiated stuff and sell yourself based on that.
Mm. Absolutely. Hey, listen, this has been really, really great chat. And I feel like we had really a strong theme here, you know, believe in yourself, a little bit Disney, but I really understand what you mean. And it's very encouraging to hear that, to sort of feel like, yeah, I will go with what I hear in my mind, because that's why I want to be a composer anyway. I don't want to be a composer just to mimic everybody else. I want to, you know, play what I want to play. So that's so nice, so encouraging to hear. So again, thank you very much for coming to this podcast.
Well, it's nice to be on. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Anything you want to mention, Simeon, before we say goodbye
no,
for
I'm
today?
No, I'm just so enjoyed this time that we had together, and it's such a great honor to meet you, John, and to hear what you're working on, and it inspires us. I'm very inspired and encouraged, you know, by what we talked about today. So, man, can't wait to hear your next thing and go back and listen to some of the beautiful things that you've already done.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Simeon, and thanks, Sam.
Yeah. And again, we're going to link everything so you can find out more about John. If you haven't listened to his music, I really recommend you do. There's some really, really interesting stuff there. So I really recommend you to check that out. So that's it for today. We will see you back in 2 weeks if all goes well. Thank you very much for listening. And if you're listening on a podcast, please thumb us up or rate us so you can hear more of our shows. Thank you very much. See you next time. Bye.